For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook, and visit arsenalfordemocracy.com to read the articles referenced in this episode. This is Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island, the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 296, recorded on February 16th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
This week's episode, 20 plus things I hate about Mike. We're talking about Mike Bloomberg. This is the episode that we're airing before the Nevada caucuses, after the New Hampshire primary. Mike Bloomberg will be on the next debate stage, even though he's not actually contesting any races officially until Super Tuesday in the beginning of March. I personally, I don't know about you, Rachel, I do not think that Mike Bloomberg has a shot at the nomination. That is not the part that I'm concerned about. The part that I am concerned about is the number of people defending him, making excuses for him, saying that he's so much better than Trump, etc. That's the part that is concerning to me, even among people that aren't supporting him as their first choice. And there's been a lot of, well, we got to support him if he's the nominee. Again, I don't think he's going to be the nominee. And I could go into many reasons why I don't think that. I think he's going to struggle to get to 15% in a lot of places. And I think that there's a lot of people in the electorate across the country, even the Democratic primary electorate, who don't particularly care for him. So I'm not that worried about it, just in terms of understanding the rules and the momentum and everything. It doesn't bother me at the moment. But Rachel, I think you would agree that there's a bigger thing at stake here, right?
Yeah, we just can't give our Democratic Party to someone who substantively isn't that different from Trump and is a billionaire trying to buy his way into our electoral system. Like, if we do that, we sacrifice everything, basically. We're sacrificing democracy at that point. So there's a lot at stake here.
Yes. I made some people upset with talking about the fact that Bernie Sanders had caucused with the Democrats in Congress for 29 years, and you had party leaders complaining about that, that he wasn't officially part of the Democratic Party, but that these some of these same party leaders, not all, a lot of them are still with Biden or whatever, but some of them are more willing to let what I would characterize as a racist Republican sex predator billionaire like Mike Bloomberg be the nominee before they would let someone like Sanders be the nominee, because, well, technically he's re-registered as a Democrat for this. But let's get going here on our list. This is not an exhaustive list by any means. This is also not a ranked list. I want to be super clear on that. This was basically a stream of consciousness as we were working on this. I put most of this list together in terms of the items, but Rachel and Nate, who couldn't be with us this week, did a lot of the research for it to fill in everything. If you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com after this episode has aired and been posted to our podcast feed, you will be able to find links on basically every single one of the items that we're talking about, because a lot of people I have found who had been defending Mike Bloomberg, once they found out about some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about today, they did actually change their mind on that, which I think is heartening, right, Rachel? So, you know, that's a good news, but we want to make sure that people have the resources to actually know about this stuff and be able to tell their friends and neighbors, hey, you know, Mike Bloomberg, actually not a good dude. All right, Rachel, start us off. Number one, this is the one that everyone is talking about, stop and frisk.
Yes. So during Bloomberg's mayoral administration, the numbers of stop and frisk stops was insane. It was in the hundreds of thousands, stopping black and brown people to see if they had any weapons, ostensibly. But really, it was kind of roughing people up, looking for contraband, i.e. marijuana. They found it on a really, really small percentage of people, which is the same percentage as people that take drugs no matter what race they are and would have drugs on their person. But because they targeted Black and brown communities, they just terrorized them. They were living in fear. They were scared to go outside because they would be stopped and frisked by cops no matter where they went. And just really, really super, super racist.
Related, obviously, fighting against police accountability and even fighting against settlements for example, Central Park 5 restitution, which, again, hard to find daylight between him and Trump, other than that, I guess, he didn't openly call for their execution, unlike Trump. And of course, they didn't actually commit the crime. Anything to comment on about that?
His administration, I think, put a lot of money into fighting, wasn't it, an unlawful arrest and an unlawful suit against the city of New York on the behalf of the Central Park Five. So just that was a case they didn't have to put money into defending. They could have settled it, but chose not to.
Okay, similarly, staying on the police theme here, number three, obsessed with making the NYPD into a world-tier, quote-unquote, army. In 2011, he gave a speech at MIT referring to the NYPD famously as my own army and the seventh largest army in the world.
Really, really terrifying. We're suffering from the effects of a militarized police force cracking down on the civilian population, and praising that is not great. Not a good look.
Yeah. Also, a bunch of people got real upset this weekend about people calling Mike Bloomberg an oligarch, which he obviously is. That, come on, don't be ridiculous. And the fact that he referred to the NYPD as essentially my own army should obviously raise similar alarm bells. Okay, switching gears slightly, and of course, we'll be coming back to some of these themes as we go. Anti-immigrant rhetoric. A lot of people talking about the importance of electing anybody over Trump and saying that we have to defeat Trump at all costs, nothing else matters, will often cite immigration and immigrant rights. For some reason, they think that Bloomberg is supportive of immigrants. I think there's plenty of evidence to say that he's not. For example, walk me through his proposal regarding Social Security cards.
Right. So in an interview, he said that we should put fingerprints, I guess, biometric data on Social Security cards. So, quote unquote, illegals can't use them to get jobs. Therefore, they wouldn't even bother crossing the border. Sounds really authoritarian and dystopian. So I wouldn't really want to go in that direction.
Next item, same concept, fingerprinting food stamp recipients. That's not something he proposed. That's something he literally did. And then defended that in a talk at the IMF with Christine Lagarde, as reported, this is in 2018, but as reported in New York Magazine a few days ago as we're recording this. Pretty straightforward. Yeah, just, you know, fingerprinting the food stamp recipients because he was obsessed with the idea that there was a lot of food stamp fraud happening. Not really true. Also, same article, same IMF talk in 2018. He said, number six, he said the minimum wage shouldn't exist and gave what I would describe as an Econ 102 level defense of abolishing the minimum wage, which we've talked about plenty of times on the show before, so don't need to go into too much detail other than to say it should be self-evident to people that creating more jobs for more people, but none of the jobs can actually support your life existence, doesn't really help. If more people have jobs that don't support them, that is less helpful than having jobs that they can actually support themselves on, which is the idea of having a minimum or even better, a living wage requirement. And on top of that, again, Econ 102 says, well, to quote the viral tweet from our friend Mark, you see why this line meets this line on this graph. That's why the poor should starve. That's the level of analysis that Econ 101 and 102 people bring to the table. If you actually look at the real world scenarios, the idea that, oh, we raised the wages, therefore employers hired fewer people and there was job losses, not really borne out in many cases. There's plenty of data that says that actually doesn't really affect that. There's a relatively straightforward reason for that. If you have people who are not on starvation wages and can actually go spend money in a demand-driven consumer economy, that creates more need for more jobs. Pretty straightforward. Okay, number seven, going back to the law and order themes, and we'll be returning to this one a few times throughout. A massive regional mosque surveillance program, completely illegal, terrible. A lot of people have said that this disrupted a lot of their personal relationships and made them suspicious of their own fellow community members because they couldn't tell if someone was trying to become friends with them or trying to entrap them as part of some sort of elaborate spy plot.
There's a HuffPost article. In the beginning, there's an anecdote. This guy gets a Facebook friend request from someone they think they know. Turns out it's a member of the NYPD trying to keep tabs on him and his fellow Muslims. And
not just in New York. This was not happening just in New York. It was the entire northeastern region.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think one person that was trying to infiltrate went so far that, like, the people in his mosque started reporting him for being really suspicious. So it was just, they were creating the problem by acting this way. They didn't uncover any secret plots, and they just really, really destroyed community ties with the Muslim community. So it was not effective at all.
And that's another thing, right? If you're going and saying we have to get rid of Trump because he did the Muslim ban, I'm sorry, Bloomberg literally did an illegal surveillance program on Muslims. He also hates Muslims. He's been pretty open about that. He's not going to be less oppressive. As some people said, the problem that many liberals seem to have with Trump is not which policies he's pursuing, but how high he's turned the dial on those policies. So if you think of it that way, Bloomberg had a lower dial setting with surveillance rather than a ban. And that's apparently okay with a lot of people who are making excuses for him. Number eight. Buying elections and endorsements, generally using his philanthropy for evil to do influence peddling and control various sort of discourse. A lot of people defending him talk about his donations to reproductive freedom organizations. They talk about his donations to environmental organizations. They talk about his donations to gun control groups. They talk about various municipal programs that he has supported, various elections that he has supported. Some people don't seem to understand why this is a problem, even as we're seeing all of these elected officials and so forth starting to, and people who have various organizations that he's donated to, making very obvious endorsements based off of that.
If you're on Twitter, you've seen the tweets about how Emily's List was afraid of angering Bloomberg because he's a huge donor. And I think they even put their name to an attack ad against Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, they were about to run one, but they canceled it after pushback.
Right. Another huge thing is CAP.
Center for American Progress.
They did a report, and there was a report on Islamophobia, and they had a chapter on Bloomberg's New York Muslim surveillance program. And they chose to quietly excise that chapter after a large donation from Bloomberg. So obviously, using his money to kind of direct these organizations and kind of help choose which way they go and what activities they partake in, which is kind of scary, and why philanthropy is not a substitute for high taxation on rich people.
The level of control that he's exercising here, I think, again, is more disturbing, even if he doesn't win the nomination, than a lot of other things. And people don't seem to understand that they're being co-opted when they defend him for having made donations to these various groups, which are supposed to prove that he's somehow much more liberal than Trump and would be in a much better direction, even if he's not your top choice for the nominee. But that brings us to number nine. If you argue that he is going to, you know, appoint and confirm better judges and things like that, or just generally be better on a bunch of these issues like the environment and reproductive freedom, look no further than the fact that he has been also putting Republicans into Congress, including the U.S. Senate, many of those same people voting in favor of the ones that are bad. I think at best case scenario, you're looking at a bunch of pretty conservative pro-business judges, which is not really compatible with actually getting a lot of these issues dealt with. Any comments on that one?
Yeah, I want to point out there was a Senate race in Pennsylvania. So Bloomberg put his money behind Toomey, and he actually prevented a progressive Democrat from winning and helped give the Senate majority to Republicans, which puts us in the situation we are in today.
Number 10, for some reason, people seem to have forgotten that Mike Bloomberg used to flirt with birtherism against Obama as well, just like Trump. That was something that Trump used to get back into the national political scene after some years of being kind of out of it for a bit. Bloomberg used to also flirt with this. I mean, this is the crazy part to me, too. Like, Bloomberg literally contemplated twice running against Obama as a third party spoiler candidate for president. And somehow people still give Bernie Sanders a harder time for saying, might be interesting if there was a primary challenge about issue ideas and 2012 against Obama, which he never acted on or pursued. Anyway, birtherism, not just restricted to Trump.
Yeah, I think in an interview, someone pointed out that Trump was a big birther or huge in the birther movement. And Bloomberg was like, I think it's actually coming from many different parties and who's to say, sort of thing. And then after Obama left office in 2016, Bloomberg said that the country was more divided on racial lines than prior to his administration, and that's somehow his fault because the job of the president is to unify the nation. Pretty weird and racist. And he also called Obama arrogant, which sounds like a pretty heavy dog whistle there. So not a great guy on race.
Certainly not. I mean, that's, again, I'm trying to just emphasize that I don't think there's any reason to think that he's less racist than Trump. That brings us to number 11. This should be also an automatic disqualification. Not only did he host the 2004 Republican National Convention, not only did he speak at it, but he specifically gave a speech on why George W. Bush's war on terror and the Iraq war were good things, and he has essentially stood by these positions. To go back to the mosque surveillance thing, a lot of his emphasis, which comes up in this speech, was that New York was somehow uniquely a target in a way that wasn't true of anywhere else in the country and needed all the help that it could get.
So I took a little excerpt out. He said, "I want to thank President Bush for supporting New York City and changing the Homeland Security funding formula and for leading the global war on terrorism. The president deserves our support. We are here to support him, and I am here to support him. We all must recognize that Homeland Security funds should be allocated by threat and no other reason. And I'll repeat this message to my fellow Republicans, Democrats, and Independents as many times as it takes so we can keep New York safe and secure." So basically underlining what you just said.
Number 12, a lot of people will say, well, Donald Trump is terrible on trans rights, so we might have to vote for Mike Bloomberg. That's obviously not true.
So in 2016, he basically said trans rights doesn't work in the Midwest for some reason. I think he's trying to say that the Midwest is more bigoted than anywhere else in the country. He said trans rights simply won't fly in the Midwest because only the intelligentsia can understand why some man wearing a dress should be in a locker room with their daughter. So really, really gross on many different levels. Just bigoted against a region of people that is not a monolith, and bigoted against trans people. There are people all over the country working hard to fight for transgender people, including in the Midwest. So just creepy and odd and a bigoted statement from Bloomberg.
Okay, number 13. What I would characterize as his policies that are authoritarian paternalist liberalism. For some reason, I'm still seeing liberals defending this. Seems weird. Also seems like why he's going to lose the by a landslide if it's a race between him and Donald Trump. Between the gun stuff and the soda taxes, come on. This is what some people have referred to as the Singapore model, which they think a lot of liberals are probably fine with, and I think it's something we've sort of gotten at a little bit in our recent episodes about, you know, climate fascism and things like that. Are you, as a liberal, prepared to live under a sort of semi-authoritarian law and order state as long as the streets are kept clean and the problems do not personally affect you and the people that you think are lesser and unworthy are being governed and controlled? The soda tax stuff seems like a weird fixation. Why is it that you would tax the drink sizes as opposed to passing regulations on the content of the sodas? Right? If there's a nutritional problem there in food, drinks, anything, you want to regulate the companies. You can more easily address the problem by regulating the production side of things, right? Number 14, if the point of this election for many liberal Democrats is to beat Trump at all costs, presumably you want someone who thinks Trump is not doing a good job and would do opposite things from him, as opposed to in the early Trump administration praising his cabinet appointments, right?
Right. In an interview, he praised Wilbur Ross, wasn't he the Secretary of Labor?
Commerce.
Mattis and Mnuchin. And he basically kind of gave a wink and said, "Oh, I knew Mnuchin's dad." So I think just kind of pointing out that the circle of elites is very small and they all know each other and they do not include you. So don't expect anyone with a D next to their name who is rubbing elbows with anyone with an R next to their name to have really different views on these cabinet appointments.
Number 15, a lot of people really understandably don't like Donald Trump because of his constant sexual assaults and sexual harassment. Unclear that that would be a substantial change under Bloomberg as well. In fact, there are more people who have made accusations against Mike Bloomberg, more women, I should say, specifically, than against Donald Trump, which is not to say that they're one is less bad than the other, because maybe that we just don't know about some of them. But yeah, there's more people on record with allegations and accusations and lawsuits and so forth against Bloomberg than against Trump. And we are talking not about a small number. We are talking about dozens of people. I'm not even getting into the Jeffrey Epstein stuff. You can look up that if you want as well. I'm just focusing on what known actual lawsuits for sexual harassment and misconduct.
Yeah, there's several witnessed incidents where he berated employees on their attractiveness or said that he would like to have sex with them openly in front of other employees. I think he made women cry by dehumanizing them and just insulting them to their face in front of people. Yeah, so I think if you want a president who's not a sexist and racist and gross predator, Bloomberg is not your choice there. I think he's just better at kind of having a respectable facade. But once you scratch the surface, you see all these dozens of incidents of just being really disgusting.
Also, famously, he's supposed to be this great guy on reproductive freedom issues, but he did once flip out at one of his female employees for getting pregnant and was like, kill it, meaning the fetus. So, like, just get an abortion and don't have a baby. Leads you to believe that possibly, much like Donald Trump for most of his career, his quote-unquote pro-choice views were that he was pro everyone except for my family should have an abortion because children are bad and you shouldn't have a choice. You should just have an abortion, which those are not synonymous things, right? So anyway, that seems like not a great view of women either. Okay, that brings us to number 16. Does he have any foreign policy differences with Trump, or is he even worse on foreign policy?
He spoke out in favor of Israel shelling a school filled with Palestinian children. They were sleeping Palestinian children. He's virulently pro-Israel. And also he's pro Chinese President Xi Jinping. He said that he is not a dictator. So pro-authoritarian, pro-right-wing politicians. So not very different from Trump.
Certainly, I think that one of the big concerns is that Trump, while not great on foreign policy issues either, and certainly having some pretty bad military decisions as well, tends to slightly more err on the side of at least questioning some of the rationale of why we do some of these things, just because he doesn't really care about being in these countries. Not that he's doing a huge amount to stop that. I don't want to overstate that. Whereas Bloomberg, I think, would be darn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, just bomb everywhere, occupy everywhere, invade everywhere, whatever. I think we'd be in World War III pretty quickly with Bloomberg. You can, I guess, quibble with me on that, but that's where I'm coming from on that one. Number 17, he has his own major news outlet that's still reporting on him. That seems pretty messed up to me. That seems like oligarch behavior. They said they weren't even going to cover the presidential campaign, and then they've continued to do so. When he gets into hot water on things like stop and frisk, they say, oh, Mike Bloomberg issuing an apology for stop and frisk and really trying to change the conversation. Okay, cool. Number 18, views on redlining and the foreclosure crisis.
He basically blamed the 2008 recession on stopping racist redlining policies. Instead, it was the banks that were giving these subprime mortgages to Black people that could just giving them way more loan than they could ever pay back, and then yanking the carpet out from underneath them once the recession hit. And so it wasn't the end of redlining that caused the housing crisis. It was the banks.
Number 19, the crackdown on Occupy Wall Street. I don't think we need to talk about it too long since we did a recent episode looking back on some things like Occupy, but just briefly recap that.
Yeah, I think we all remember that getting the people out of Zuccotti Park turned pretty violent pretty quickly. We've talked about the militarized police force. So that definitely played a part in that as well. Pretty bad.
Number 20, education and teachers. He seems to hate teachers.
Yeah. He's very pro charter school. He's pro closing schools that are quote unquote failing. There's a quote from 2011. He said, "If I had it my way, I'd dump half of NYC's teachers." In another speech, he said, "Just double up on classrooms, and that way you can get your good teacher teaching a class with, I guess, 60 students in it. And of course, if you have a good teacher, it doesn't matter what the class size is." Flying in the face of all known educational research.
Yeah, the 60-person classrooms was sort of remarkable. And as Nate said, it's not like his daughters were, you know, at their private school in similar conditions. They were in 6-person classrooms, 6-to-1 ratios. So apparently he wants 10 times more people in a classroom. And as folks on Twitter who were actually in New York public schools at the time said, they were sitting on radiators and stuff like that because there weren't enough desks in the rooms. Final item. This broke just as we were getting ready to record. Number 21, support for literal death panels, not figurative, like imaginary made up Obamacare death panels. He actually thought that was a good idea and that we should go ahead and do it. For example, saying that if a 95-year-old is diagnosed with cancer, you should say, "You're out of luck. Too bad. So sad." Anyway.
Yeah. So the specter of Sarah Palin is coming back to haunt us, I guess. Literal death panels.
All right. That's going to be it for us. Thank you, Rachel. And also thank you, Nate, who's not here. But thank you, Rachel, for putting this together. Again, arsenalfordemocracy.com to find all of the links to all the things we've talked about today. So you can tell your friends and family not to vote for Mike Bloomberg. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.